It's Thursday, December 1st. Money's based on trust, and he's all out of trust. We start here. For the first time since his crypto empire collapsed, Sam Bankman-Fried sits down for a broadcast network interview.
How do you explain the failure? Was it inattention, arrogance?
It's a good question.
Was it unethical?
George Stephanopoulos is here to explain why it's rocking the entire financial world. Same-sex marriage is already the law of the land. Now it's about to be covered by an actual law.
It's really a rare show of bipartisanship. We don't really get a lot of those moments around here.
After one of Nancy Pelosi's last big achievements as Speaker, a new generation is ready to take over for her. And their home value sprang up by more than 50%. All they had to do was put a white woman inside of it.
The only thing bringing down the value of my home was me.
An ABC nationwide investigation reveals the alarming math of the home appraisal industry. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. As inflation has risen, the money you've had sitting in that checking account has had less buying power. Central banks have cranked up interest rates, which has made mortgages more expensive, which has led lots of digital evangelists to say, dude, this is why you've got to invest in crypto.
Like I was saying, it's FTX. It's a safe and easy way to get into crypto.
Yeah, I don't think so. And I'm never wrong about this stuff. Never.
Over the last several years, we have seen an absolute explosion of digital currencies that are independent of any banking system. Bitcoin is the best known, but the list goes on. And if you're watching all these ads, it can feel like everyone else is making money but you. That is not an accident. The entire industry, and it is an industry now, really predicates itself on mass adoption. As in, once we all use this, the early investors will reap a fortune. But it's not a given anyone will use a certain cryptocurrency, and unlike regular money, anyone can create one of these. So, what you end up with is a confused public, worry that they're missing out, and a ton of celebrities telling them crypto is the future.
Miami, it's the crypto queen, Paris Hilton here.
And I'm Naomi Osaka, and I'm proud to partner with FTX.
Celebrities who have, of course, bet big themselves on crypto being the future. And that's what was so enraging when one of the largest crypto exchanges on Earth imploded.
FTX has its name on arenas, but now it's filing for bankruptcy. Its founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, is out.
FTX was led by a crypto finance guy named Sam Bankman-Fried.
We are the second or third largest exchange globally, depending on what metrics you use, processing about $15 billion per day of trading volume.
Using his service, you could deposit and withdraw these various cryptocurrencies. You could turn your Bitcoin into Ethereum. You could turn that Ethereum into Dogecoin. You could cash out whenever you want.
Venture capital firms were literally gushing in profiles over him being a genius and how completely mesmerized they were by his intellect and insights.
But when reports emerged that the cryptocurrency created by FTX was propping up lots of other investments and suddenly the price of that currency was dropping dramatically, well, the whole company's value started to plummet and everyone raced to pull their money out at once.
Can you ballpark for us what you invested? How much you're losing on this?
Double-digit millions is what I'm saying.
Now, the company's bankrupt, crypto alarm bells are ringing, and Sam Bankman-Fried has become one of the most sought-after interviews in the world. SBF, as he's known, hasn't given any on-camera broadcast network interviews until now. He decided to sit down with ABC's own George Stephanopoulos, who joins us now. Hey, George.
Hey, Brad.
Thanks for being here. So we've been hearing Sam Bankman-Fried's own advisors were telling him, don't speak to the press. And here he is. He's spoken to you. Why? Why did he want to talk to you?
Well, all I can tell you is he really wanted to talk. There is no question about that. Our incredible booking team was in contact with him. And I got an email when I woke up on Thanksgiving morning at around 4 saying SBF wants to talk to you. And I said, wow, I'm shocked. Great. And we followed up. I had a brief phone conversation with him on Saturday. We talked for about 5 minutes and he said, okay, come on down. And I flew down to the Bahamas on Sunday. We did the interview on Monday, sat down for 2 hours, maybe an hour and 55 minutes.
Thank you for doing this.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And he just had a lot to get off his chest. Clearly, wanted to get through this. I mean, I got to tell you, at some level, it felt like a therapy session. Mm. Now, you're right. I mean, any lawyer would say, what are you kidding me? You shouldn't be talking right now. But I think he defied that advice and felt that it was really important for him to get his story out. The basics are, he says he screwed up.
How do you explain the failure? Was it inattention, arrogance?
It's a good question.
Was it unethical?
I've spent a lot of time trying to think about that over the last month, about what, obviously, I now have a lot more of a sense of, you know, operationally what I did wrong and what I should have done better, but why wasn't I on top of my game?
And he feels very, very sorry and wants to try to make investors whole. He's still holding out hope that he can. You know, that which led to a series of questions where I said, are you sure you're not deluding yourself here?
Some part of it was just literal distraction. I really should have spent some time each day taking a step back and saying, what are the most important things here?
Can you begin to explain where this went wrong? And I know there are lots of twists and turns here and finance words, but the basic issue sounds like he had FTX. He also had this crypto investment group that started buying up huge amounts of this FTX-made currency. So he's buying stuff from himself, which makes it look super valuable, but then you dig a little deeper and what? There's nothing there?
The fundamental problem that could be grounds for criminal investigation, maybe eventually charges, is you're not supposed to take depositors' funds and use them for other purposes. In fact, the terms of service of FTX say you can't do that, and it's kind of a bright red line in almost all securities law.
It was only in the last month that I put together the magnitudes of everything, and that I fully understood the, you know, fiat transfer mechanisms that had been happening.
Crypto is in this nebulous regulation space, so he's trying to maintain that it wasn't illegal, that it wasn't improper, but that's going to be in the end for prosecutors and regulators to decide. But
I guess the main question is, like, he told you he screwed up. Did he screw up, or was he defrauding people?
Well, that's the question, and that's what investigators are going to have to decide. He insists that he was not defrauding people. He kind of confesses to panicking in the moment and not doing a good enough job of managing risk.
Now, you said one of your great talents in a podcast was managing risk.
That's right. And
it's obviously wrong.
I think that there's something maybe even deeper wrong there, which was I wasn't even trying. Like, I wasn't spending any time or effort trying to manage risk on FTX. And that obviously,
that's a stunning admission.
What?
That's a pretty stunning admission.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. Like, what happened, happened. And like, if I had been spending an hour a day thinking about risk management on FTX, I don't think that would have happened.
I mean, I asked him straight out. I said, a lot of people look at you and see Bernie Madoff. Mm-hmm. And he went into great detail about how, well, no, mine wasn't a Ponzi scheme. I said, but it had Ponzi-like elements to it. And he said that, no, it was a real business. He wasn't defrauding people. One of the things I confessed to Sam in the interview is, I don't understand crypto.
This is not your thing, huh?
But I was asking the questions from the point of view of an average person,
right,
who follows it and is trying to figure out what is happening as well. And there are a lot of hype went into it, a lot of branding. We talked about that, you know, him hiring all these celebrities, naming a stadium, buying a Super Bowl ad. And he said that was part of the game too.
That's the thing, is it feels like the whole space is, there's an opportunity to be a charlatan. And his whole thing was, there is an opportunity. I'm not one of the charlatans. And yet here we are.
And I guess we're going to find out. But we learned a lot in this 2 hours.
Fascinating. All that on GMA today and throughout the day. George Stephanopoulos, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brad.
We've seen some history made in Congress in the last 24 hours. A rail strike on the verge of being possibly averted. A new generation of Democratic leaders voted into power. And, oh yeah, the House Ways and Means Committee now officially has its hands on President Trump's tax returns. After a court ruling, the Treasury Department sent them on over to Congress yesterday. But the biggest news was, for the first time in our nation's history, the House of Representatives have voted to enshrine same-sex marriage in law. Let's get caught up on all this. ABC's congressional correspondent Rachel Scott is at the Capitol right now. First off, Rachel, how significant was this vote on same-sex marriage, and what does it mean for gay couples?
Yeah, well, Brad, I'll say this is a pretty big deal here. First, because it's really a rare show of bipartisanship. We don't really get a lot of those moments around here that much anymore.
The bill, as amended, has passed.
Mr. President, what a great day. What a great day.
You had 12 Senate Republicans join every single Democrat to vote for legislation to safeguard, to protect same-sex and interracial marriage. And this is something that's deeply personal for a lot of senators, for a lot of people in this chamber.
And this will give millions of loving couples the certainty, the dignity, and the respect that they need and that they deserve.
I was in the chamber as this bill passed, and I was watching Senator Tammy Baldwin. She's the first openly gay person elected to Congress. She talked about what this means to her. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, the first openly bisexual member of the Senate, was in near tears.
I can't wait for people all across the country to be able to talk to their children and their children's children about the time in America when we made it completely normal.
So there is no question about it, Brad. This is a historic move, but it also goes to show in the months following Roe versus Wade being overturned that Democrats here wanted to move forward with protecting other rights. They feared that other rights could also be in jeopardy.
I was going to say, it's not as if gay people can't get married right now, like the Supreme Court says they can, but that Supreme Court ruling could go away. Rachel, you also had this potential rail strike. We talked about it yesterday and how Congress was going to try to pass something to essentially squash the strike. Where do we stand on that? Because we sort of thought something would be passed at this point.
Yeah, so Congress essentially, Brad, took the very first step to avoid what honestly would be a catastrophic shutdown of the nation's railroads. We are talking about something that could cost the economy. It could cost businesses and consumers up to $2 billion a day. It would drive up the cost of everything from gas to groceries right before the holiday season. So the House did pass a bill that would prevent this rail strike. But I will say that this move is also controversial. You know, this deal does give rail workers their biggest raise in decades, but it only includes one additional day of paid leave. And you have several unions that are calling for more. We even talked to one rail worker in Lincoln, Nebraska. He was actually homesick just yesterday with the flu. He says that he hopes that his manager approves it as vacation time because otherwise he's not going to get a paycheck.
The scary part about that is, you know, I don't have paid sick leave. So I am going to be using vacation time right now. And I feel like it shouldn't take 3.5 years. I should not have to go 3.5 years without a raise to see this process through.
And there's been a lot of debate about this among lawmakers. Brad, I could tell you that this is probably the only thing that I've seen Senator Marco Rubio and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez agree on in terms of wanting to get these paid sick leave days up for these rail workers. And so the House did pass a separate measure to increase the number of additional paid leave days to 7, but only 3 Republicans supported that measure, and it could face way more roadblocks in the Senate.
Why should the federal government force a contract on workers that they have explicitly rejected, force this on them, and they don't have any say on it? That just seems wrong to me.
Where some Republicans essentially believe that this should be left up to the workers to decide with their unions and the rail companies.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Senate still has to pass this, and it's not completely clear whether they'll reach an agreement on what should pass. Last question, Rachel. Nancy Pelosi stepping down as speaker. She'll still be a congresswoman, but we saw Democrats vote yesterday on who their new leaders will be starting next January. What did that vote tell us about this sort of new crop of Democrats going forward?
Well, Brad, this is essentially going to usher in a new generation of leadership. You have Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. He is now going to be the new Democratic leader.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor to stand before you today.
He's the first Black lawmaker to lead a party in Congress. He's making history, but he's also going to have some challenges. I mean, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was leading Democrats for decades. She got the respect that few have here on Capitol Hill, and she was also able to really keep her caucus in line. And that is a big challenge for someone like Congressman Jeffries, especially when the margins are just so close. Mm. And remember, come January, it's not Democrats who are going to be in the majority in the House. It's going to be Republicans.
Right. The Republicans are going to be trying to peel away votes any chance they get from Democrats to pass their agenda. All right, Rachel, that's how I guess, do you have Trump's taxes yet, Rachel? Like, have those leaked yet? You have your hands on them?
We're making calls, Brad. Don't you worry.
Okay. Sounds good. Rachel Scott there at the Capitol. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, same neighborhood, same house, same value, but different owners getting vastly different prices. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Married moms in the suburbs. They've been called soccer moms. They've been called security moms.
Pamela Wilk is a so-called soccer mom.
Those so-called Walmart moms.
She calls herself a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms.
The hockey mom trying to connect with the soccer moms.
In the 1990s, the idea of soccer moms as the quintessential swing voter took hold. Elections could be won or lost based on a candidate's ability to appeal to them. But were quote-unquote soccer moms actually the deciding factor? In a new series on the 538 Politics podcast, we take a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from, and does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts.
We have all spent lots of time the last several days trying to get deals, right? Trying to shave a couple hundred bucks off here or there on Black Friday, Cyber Monday. But if you own a house, that can define your financial life. No other expenditure comes close. And in recent years, we have learned that as people try to leverage their property to improve their own lives, many are told, sorry, this place actually isn't worth as much as you thought it was. Disproportionately, those unlucky ones are people of color.
Today, state leaders held a hearing on the topic of racially biased home appraisals.
Black and Latino families who say appraisals on their homes are low and that race is likely a factor.
Julian Glover is a reporter with our affiliate KGO in San Francisco, and for the last 2 years, he's been reporting on the racial disparities in housing with our partners from ABC's owned and operated stations around the country. He hosts the documentary Lowballed, which premieres on Hulu tomorrow night. He's with us now. Julian, when I hear San Francisco, the words that come to mind are expensive housing, right? But why did you start looking at like the whole home appraisal industry? Why was that the thing?
Well, first off, we do have some of the most expensive housing in the country. You're talking to someone who pays way too much money every month in rent. But for people who are lucky enough to own their own home, the appraisal industry is something that's been top of mind for them, particularly over the last couple of years. Remember the early days of the pandemic, everyone was looking to stay in their home. So that meant people were looking to refinance their existing mortgages. And we told the story of this incredible, beautiful family in Marin City, California. It's in the North Bay, just about 5 miles north of San Francisco and the Golden Gate Bridge, who had their home underappraised, lowballed in a home appraisal by $500,000.
I love the community aspect of Marin City.
We had an unbelievable difference here with this one family, the Austins.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
That's good.
So they were going to get their home refinanced, and they got hit with an appraised value they just knew was way too low.
What's going through your mind when you get that first appraisal?
Oh, I'm upset. How's this going to impact the rate that we're trying to get? How's this going to impact the money that we're trying to take out of the house?
They happen to be Black, and they believe that's the reason they had their home value appraised drastically lower than it should have been.
It was deflating because I knew what other properties had sold for.
A nearly $500,000, let me say it again, $500,000 appraisal gap after they took down their artwork, their photos, and then had one of their best friends, who happens to be white, stand in a subsequent home appraisal and bringing in her own family photos. And that's
wait,
when
sorry,
they...
Wait, so explain this to me. They had a white, like, just their white friend pretend to own the house and, like, see if a different home appraiser gave it a different value?
Absolutely.
We had a conversation with one of our white friends, and she is like, no problem, I'll be Tanisha, I'll bring over some pictures of my family.
And then they got the appraised value back, and it jumped by an unbelievable amount, $500,000.
I want to ask you about the erasure that you all had to perform in taking down your artwork, your family photos.
It was humiliating, right?
It's hard to take down who you are because you're not sure if who you are is good enough. You should never have to think about that. It should never be a question like, is this the reason why? Because it's not the countertops. It's not the view. It's not the floors. It's not the fireplace.
What the lady saw was the color of our skin.
The appraisal and the appraiser really is the cog in the machine when you're going to refinance your property. Essentially, the lender is hiring an appraiser to go out. So if you have an existing mortgage from a bank or you're trying to go with a new lender altogether, to make sure that the home has enough value for them to be able to finance the property. So if something happens, they can be able to sell the home and they know that they will be able to recoup the money that they've loaned to you for that home mortgage. So if the appraised value comes in too low, then you don't get the mortgage. You don't get to refinance. In this case, you don't get to save hundreds, in some cases, Brad, even upwards of $1,000 a month on your mortgage.
Is there a sense as to why? Like, I hear you saying black and brown families are getting different price estimates from these appraisers. Why is that? Like, is there something that makes somebody walk into their house and go, oh, this is not worth that much money?
One of the key things that we were able to dig into in this reporting is the idea that so much of this is linked to historically racist housing practices.
Now, I haven't looked at every single residential security survey, but every single one I've looked at, if there are any Black people in the area, it's graded the worst grade. It's designated as a hazardous area.
We're talking about things like redlining that go back almost a century at this point.
It's the systemic, institutionalized association between race and risk.
Where the appraisers are selecting the comps, the comparable homes that recently sold, and where they're deciding not to pull those comps from, in many cases, is determining the outcome of the appraisal and determines if you get that refinance or if you're able to purchase a new property.
Like, this is like this other house that we've seen, and it's in the Black neighborhood, and it's not like, and it's worth this amount of money. And yet, what, all of a sudden, when a white person's living there, they're like, actually, it's more like this house.
Exactly. And wow, the disparities are mind-blowing.
And then I'm getting all this mail saying, you know, refinance, refinance, refinance. So I'm like, this is the time to do it. And we get to the appraisal.
We introduce you to Carlette Duffy in Indianapolis, who literally, Brad, had the value of her home double.
Removing everything that represented me, my family, my culture.
After having a white friend stand in and taking down all of her pictures and artwork,
it just hits me that I was right and that it was me. The only thing bringing down the value of my home was me.
This isn't just happening to a few families. These aren't one-offs. Our ABC News data journalism team was able to find that in refinance applications in predominantly Black neighborhoods, they're nearly five times more likely to be underappraised than in white communities. It's also the case in home purchase loans, too, that in Black neighborhoods, they're more than twice as likely to appraise under value. So this isn't just happening in a few neighborhoods across the country or to a few families. This is truly systemic.
Unreal. Does this say something about the appraisal industry then, Julian? Like, is this something these big appraisal groups are going to have to deal with?
Yeah, I think something that we found in our reporting is just how homogenous, or in other words, how not diverse the appraisal industry is at large. We're talking about perhaps one of the whitest industries in this country at upwards of 96-97% white, 70% male.
These are people who were raised, they were trained in the field to say that race matters. Communities of color are devalued.
Like, you really can't find another profession in this country that looks like this.
So they're bringing all of those biases with them when they are making their decisions, even if it's not conscious.
A lot of that has to do with how you become an appraiser in this country. It's really been a profession that's been passed down from grandfather to father and from father to son. You have to get 1,000 hours of supervised training from a current licensed appraiser to become an appraiser. So why would I take you under my wing if in a couple of years you're going to be my competition in trying to appraise homes, you know, in a particular area. So that's blocked people of color, that's blocked women from getting into the field for so long.
Fascinating reporting. This documentary, Lowballed, premieres on Hulu tomorrow night. Julian Glover, really interesting. Thanks so much.
We appreciate it. Thank you, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, you want to raise? How many milk and cookies is it going to take? One last thing is next.
People who disappear without a trace.
Where is she?
The most notorious murder cases in New York.
Pure evil.
And the most devious killers.
There's a Hannibal Lecter feel to him.
For chilling true crime stories, follow the True Crime NYC podcast wherever you listen.
And one last thing. We're officially in December, which means it's Santa season. Kids around the country are looking for a lap to sit on. There's just one problem. There's a Santa shortage.
Hey, Brad, how are you today?
I feel underdressed, man. That's how I'm doing.
Hey, this is how we always dress here at Hire Santa.
That's Mitch Allen, who was talking to me on Zoom from what kind of looks like a North Pole workshop, and he's dressed in a bright green elf suit.
And I'm the founder and head elf at Hire Santa.
Hire Santa is a Texas-based company founded as a kind of agency for Santas, from mall Santas to parade Santas to the guy that shows up at the office Christmas party.
We help brands associate themselves with Christmas through the use of holiday entertainers, primarily Santa. You know, that's our milk and cookies.
But this year, he says, supply just isn't meeting demand.
For every Santa that reaches out to us, there are 20 people reaching out to us for Santa events.
What's happening is people are back to arranging Santa visits at pre-pandemic levels. Lots of families are less concerned about the risks of COVID.
COVID has been particularly hard on the Santa Claus community.
But the average Santa, he says, is very much concerned about COVID. He can't afford not to be.
Santas are at a higher risk for a negative outcome if they get COVID. Just the demographics of this group of gentlemen. And so, yes, we lost a great number of Santas, unfortunately, as well as Santas every year age out and they decide to hang up the red coat. And so we estimate that over the last few years, we lost about 10% of our Santas. And we've been trying to get more and more Santas to fill those jobs.
He also mentioned there was a bigger push than ever for diverse Santas. Different races, sure, but also Santas who can speak Spanish, Santas who can use American Sign Language. People don't just want to meet Santa, they want to meet a Santa who really seems to see them. But as our conversation went on, I noticed something. When Mitch talked about what he looked for in a Santa, he was being extra jolly to me. Was he just being nice? Or was he trying to recruit me?
Now listen, you've got a good beard. We can bleach that beard up a little bit, let it grow out. You can definitely be a Santa next year.
Wait, you think? Is this, how would an interview to become a Santa, how would that go exactly?
Well, first of all, we got to make sure you got a clean background check.
And on this call in his Snow Globe Zoom room, he began a job interview with me, just in case I needed some seasonal work.
Brad, how many reindeer does Santa have?
Okay, I know this. How many? He's got eight.
Eight? Are you sure?
He's got eight. Eight reindeer.
I think you're leaving one off, but okay. Now, what are the names of the reindeer?
Oh, no. Did I forget? Did I make Rudolph one of the eight, but Rudolph is actually the ninth?
Let's see. Can you name all the reindeer?
Okay. Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Blitzen, Comet, Cupid, Rudolph.
Donner?
Oh, no. Mitch, we got a dog for Christmas, and his name was Donner, and I just forgot Donner. Okay, so maybe I wasn't super prepared for this job interview. Mitch said that was no problem because Hire Santa could recommend some Santa schools, these are a real thing, where Santas exchange tips and best practices, from beard maintenance to how to answer questions from inquisitive kids to holiday jokes.
Do you know where Santa keeps money at the North Pole?
All his money?
He keeps it in a snowbank.
Wait, you're just in charge. Wait, if you're a Santa, you're just in charge of making terrible puns. That's the job.
Listen, when you hang around with a bunch of Santa Claus entertainers, it sort of goes with the territory.
My beard might have some gray in it, but I didn't think I was Santa age yet. Jeez. If you're a big Christmas person, hope your December is off to a fantastic start. Our producer Kelly Therese already has her tree up. I'm Brad Milkey. I'm off for a couple days, but you will have some very merry guest hosts. I'll see you next week. I don't have it.
Mm.
married moms in the suburbs. They've been called soccer moms. They've been called security moms.
Pamela Wilk is a so-called soccer mom.
Those so-called Walmart moms.
She calls herself a hockey mom.
I love those hockey moms.
The hockey mom trying to connect with the soccer moms.
In the 1990s, the idea of soccer moms as the quintessential swing voter took hold. Elections could be won or lost based on a candidate's ability to appeal to them. But were quote-unquote soccer moms actually the deciding factor? In a new series on the 538 Politics podcast, we take a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from, and does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts.